My thought is that he will almost certainly write that book. I'm not so sure, though, that he'll rewrite the rest of the books in the series, because the temptation to do so is tempered with the fact that there are new books crying to be written, and his time with each passing year becomes even more precious. Once again, Dark Tower fans will have to wait and see, which is always a frustrating situation. It's one that fellow fantasist George R.R. Martin fans are currently dealing with, because his saga, Song of Ice and Fire, is a work in progress, which has frustrated fans. Some churlish readers have complained online, adamantly insisting that Martin has an obligation to finish the series before attending to other projects, attending conventions, or giving more interviews. Other readers have speculated about his health, worried that he may die before completing the series. It happens. The last Gormenghast novel, Titus Awakes, was posthumously published as a fragment, owing to Mervyn Peake's death in 1968. As Neil Gaiman explained to one impatient fan who had the expectation that Martin should stop everything he's doing, personal and professional, to complete the Fire and Ice story cycle, George R.R. Martin is not your bitch. The same holds true for Stephen King. Your Roadmap to the Dark Tower. When it comes to books about the Dark Tower, I am of the firm opinion that such books should only be read after the reader has finished the series, just as you should not watch the supplementary material provided on DVDs until after viewing the movie itself. For instance, if you've yet to read Tolkien's epic fantasy, The Lord of the Rings, a book that inspired King, influencing not only the Dark Tower series but also The Stand, you are best advised to read The Hobbit first, since it lays the groundwork for the larger, more ambitious books to follow, and then read, in order, The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and The Return of the King. After that, you're free to round out your reading with the multi-volume book series The Complete History of Middle-earth or the many non-fiction studies on Tolkien's considerable body of work. The correct chronology for reading the Dark Tower novels in order. 1. The revised edition of The Gunslinger, because of the inclusion of an additional 9,000 words. 2. The Drawing of the Three. 3. The Wastelands. 4. Wizard and Glass. 5. The Wind Through the Keyhole. 6. The Wolves of the Kala. 7. The Song of Susanna. 8. The Dark Tower. The Little Sisters of Illyria is not available in any trade edition. Now out of print, it was initially available in an anthology, Legends, and subsequently from Donald M. Grant Publisher, in a beautiful edition that includes the story paired with a rewritten The Gunslinger and artwork by Michael Whalen. If you want to read the short story, The Little Sisters of Illyria, it will likely appear in a future collection of King's short fiction, perhaps in King's The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, due out November 2015. To guide you to the Dark Tower, I highly recommend Robin Firth's exhaustive and authoritative concordance, Stephen King's The Dark Tower, The Complete Concordance, Revised and Updated, 2012, which incorporates The Little Sisters of Illyria and The Wind Through the Keyhole. In his foreword to the book, Stephen King points out that I needed some sort of exhaustive written summary of everything that had gone before, a Dark Tower concordance that would be easy to search when I needed to find a reference in a hurry. When King asked his mentor and longtime friend Burton Hatlin for a recommendation, Hatlin recommended Robin Firth, and my wandering gunslinger had found his Boswell, wrote King. Firth's concordance is an exhaustive work of scholarship and honors the Dark Tower story cycle and King as well. Like carrying an American Express card in the real world, I wouldn't travel through mid-world without this concordance as my constant companion. And if you need another recommendation, here's King's endorsement from his foreword to Firth's book. I found this overview of in-world, mid-world, and end-world both entertaining and invaluable. So, I am convinced, will you? 38. Michael Whalen, illustrating The Dark Tower. As King critic Dr. Tony Magistrale points out, The Dark Tower reflects King's career-long fascination with culling together diverse genres, the epic, the western, the gothic romance, science fiction, fantasy, all these things into a hybrid text where various elements of literary and cinematic traditions interface and coalesce. And they do so in a way that's totally unexpected. Clearly, this story presented a formidable challenge for any illustrator. But Michael Whalen was up to the task. I asked him to give me a sense of what it was like to read the first book in manuscript form. I found The Gunslinger to be an extremely depressing book, despite feeling flattered to have been asked to do it in the first place, Whalen said. It was January 1981 when I began work on the assignment, a stressful month for me all around. My mother had just died a couple of weeks before. The children of our family's closest friends died in a car crash on I-95, and John Lennon had been killed. The weather was blustery and icy. To tell you the truth, the last thing I wanted to do was illustrate The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger. I was just not in the mood. In addition, Michael and his wife, Audrey, had just become parents for the first time. The birth of their daughter, Alexa, meant that they came to know all about the joys of sleep deprivation and round-the-clock feeding schedules. Finding himself with back-to-back assignments for specialty presses, Whalen was initially daunted by the demands of illustrating two dark and disturbing books, Charles Grant's Tales from the Dark Side, followed by King's The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger. But in the end, I rolled up my sleeves and got into it. Whalen said. Once I started making sketches, things started going quickly. I prepared some watercolor board panels and started painting, and soon found myself lost in the story. But in retrospect, I don't know why I didn't do some research by watching all the Clint Eastwood movies. Ordinarily, I would have thought that to be part of my homework. I'm really puzzled by this because there's so obviously an influence on King's Gunslinger. But I suppose my thinking was to jump into the project with both feet and complete the commission without delay. I can't go back and do them over again, but I wish I had seen the movies and visited the Southwest before attempting to begin the artwork. Whalen rendered 5 paintings and several pen and ink pieces for The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, including an iconic image of Roland sitting on a beach with the nebulous outline of the Dark Tower in the distance, set against a blood-red sun. The original painting sold for $1,750. I could easily get up to $35,000 for that today, Whalen shrugs. Whoever bought it got a good deal. For the trade paperback edition, published in 1988, Whalen painted the background a peculiar mustardy color that seemed to express the dusty, oppressive feeling of the book to me, he wrote in The Art of Michael Whalen. The portrait depicts Roland in profile with a raven on his shoulder. The resemblance between Roland and King is deliberate. I had a profile shot of Steve that I used because, at that point, he was describing the gunslinger in terms of having similar features of his, so I thought he should look faintly like Steve. There's only one scene when you really see Roland well. He and Cuthbert are standing at the foot of the hanged figure of Hax. I deliberately gave him a Stephen King feeling to his face because it felt to me that he had already inserted himself into the story, into Roland's character. Even at that early stage, I had no idea that he would write himself in as an actual character in The Dark Tower, Book 7, 2004. I just felt that. So you can see King's dark hair and some of his facial planes. King's description of Roland evolves through the series. At first, he's described as a hard-bitten guy with a face that seems chiseled out of obdurate granite. Then to Susanna, he says he looks like he has the face of a tired poet, and so on. I became something of a weather vane in response to King's changing descriptions, responding to different sections as I encountered them. I came to accept that Roland would change over time and become a more sympathetic and complex character. I feel I got a good fix on him now, but it went through a lot of change in the process. The way I depicted him on the cover of Book 7, The Dark Tower, was a pastiche of all the hard guys in the movies that I could think of. There's some of James Coburn in his face, some Lee Marvin, and a little bit of Clint Eastwood. There are different people I think of when I painted the face on the cover of the book, but now I admit I regret having done so. I wish I had thrown his face into shadow. Everyone has a slightly different idea of what the character looks like, even me, and to fix it so solidly was a mistake. Ah, well, live and learn. Over time, I believe I've settled on how I think Roland should look. You'd think it late in the game to do that, after having illustrated so much of the material, but my conception of a character evolved over time, just as Steve's idea of Roland's appearance evolved considerably over the course of the 7 books. I feel I've gotten closer and closer to the mark. Just as Roland's look proved illustratively elusive, so too did the look of the Dark Tower itself. "That's the other thing," Wayland said. "King doesn't get around to describing what the damned Dark Tower looks like until the end of the last book. He has scenes of different characters throughout the series that see the tower appearing one way or another, as if the tower itself changes its look depending on who is confronting it. Consequently, I tried not to be too specific about it. There's all kinds of room for interpretation, until King definitively portrays it in the last book as a rather plain, squat tower." What was it like to come full circle and illustrate the 7th Dark Tower novel? I was so stoked. I must have whooped and hollered for 2 days. To be asked back to do it again made my year. Wayland rose to the challenge and turned in more artwork than what the contract called for. In the end, he submitted 25 paintings in color and monochrome and 34 pen and ink illustrations. "Any final thoughts about the Dark Tower?" I asked. Wayland replied, "Well, the story's not long enough. I'm not sure it ever can be." He laughed. After his accident, King surely had a flash of his own mortality and didn't want to leave the roundness of the saga incomplete. Like so many other fans, I'm hoping there will be more additions to the whole story, if for no other reason than that the number 9 is so important to the whole series. I always felt it should have been a 9-book series. Certainly, there's plenty of more room to explore unanswered issues. "In any case," Wayland concluded, "I love the books and the characters. Some may complain about it being too long, but as King explains in the 7th book, it's not the destination, but the journey that is important. The road can be as long as you choose to make it." Michael Whalen, A Portfolio. And if you are one of those who have never visited the strange world through which Roland and his friends move, I hope you will enjoy the marvels you find there. More than anything else, I wanted to tell a tale of wonder. Stephen King on The Dark Tower Story Cycle. From the foreword to The Little Sisters of Illyria, 2008. Later in this book, you'll find a 16-page color insert of artwork drawn by artist Michael Whalen, inspired by Stephen King's Dark Tower series. Whalen and King go all the way back to 1982, when the first Dark Tower book was published by Donald M. Grant. He mailed his customers a sales flyer stating that The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger, was unlike anything best-selling author Stephen King has ever written. Indeed, it is unlike anything anyone has ever written, and it is a volume that begs for illustrations. The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger is a joining of the foremost author and artist in the fields of science fiction and fantasy. Complimenting Stephen King in this most unusual of books is artist Michael Whalen, recipient of both Howard and Hugo Awards as Best Artist in the Genre. "We both thought that Michael was at the top of the game," Grant recalled to me in 1988. "Stephen King certainly liked Michael's work, so we were in accord there." Waylon accepted the commission and threw himself into the project with brio. He eventually rendered 5 full-color paintings in acrylic, color end leaves, also in acrylic, and chapter head illustrations with complementary end piece illustrations in pen and ink. Grant recalled that King was very pleased with Waylon's finished work. 22 years later, Waylon was once again approached by King to illustrate a Dark Tower novel, this time the final book in the series, The Dark Tower 7, The Dark Tower 2004. In a phone call to Waylon, King explained that because they both started out on a quest to tell Roland's story in the first book, it seemed only fitting that they should end it together as well, with which Waylon concurred. As with the first Dark Tower novel, Waylon approached the final book commission with unbridled enthusiasm, resulting in a remarkable suite of paintings and drawings. It's not hyperbole to state that Waylon's work for the final Gunslinger novel towers above all the previously published artwork in the series, including his own. In Book 7, Waylon exhibited a mature vision of Roland's world, a technical mastery in all media, and an unsurpassed imagination that firmly cemented his reputation as the preeminent Dark Tower artist. Not surprisingly, years later, King turned to Waylon to illustrate Discordia, an online interactive experience based on the Dark Tower series on his official website. Without further ado, let me welcome you to Michael Waylon's illustrative world. 39. Christine, 1983. This is the story of a lover's triangle, I suppose you'd say. Arnie Cunningham, Lee Cabot, and, of course, Christine. But I want you to understand that Christine was there first. I think she was his only true love. So I call what happened a tragedy. Stephen King, prologue to Christine. In the afterword to Different Seasons, King recounts a conversation with Alan Williams, his editor, who asked him, "Loved Cujo. Have you thought about what you're going to do next?" King suggested a novella collection titled Different Seasons, which wasn't what his crestfallen book editor wanted to hear. Collections don't sell as well as novels. King then said, "How about a haunted car?" That was what he wanted to hear. King, who wrote about a haunted hotel, would now write a horror story about a haunted car, which was a first. Haunted houses were plentiful, done to perfection in Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, but a haunted car? In retrospect, given the milieu he had grown up in during the 50s, a time when cars and rock and roll held sway, King was driven to write about American car culture. In fact, another baby boomer named George Lucas did just that, writing and directing American Graffiti, 1973. A coming-of-age movie that paid homage to rock and roll and cruising in cars, as does Christine. Cars, a consuming interest of Lucas's, are chariots of fire. In the movie, the teenage boys driving them are contemporary knights, driving supercharged cars powered by powerful engines. In an interview with Randy L'Officier in 1984, King explained what it was like growing up in the 50s. "That was my generation. So there are a lot of us who actually developed our understanding of life and who grew to be not adults, but thinking human beings in the 50s. Somebody once said that life was the rise of consciousness. For me, rock and roll was the rise of consciousness. It was like a big sun bursting over my life. That's when I really started to live. And that was brought on by the music of the 50s. I don't have any bad memories of the 50s. There was stuff going on. There was an uneasiness about the atomic bomb, but On the whole, I'd have to say that people in the 50s were pretty loose. The car itself, as King explained to Randy LeFissier, is a symbol for the technological age, or for the end of innocence, when it plays such a part in adolescence and growing up. In short, it's King's horror version of American Graffiti. King sold the book to his publisher for $1, as he explained to Locus, January 1983. I wanted not to be taking a lot of cash, which I didn't need, and it ties up money other writers could get for advances. On Christine, the first time they sell a book, they're in the black. I'm in the black. There are no staggered payments. It's hard to stagger a dollar. Michael Collings on Christine. Christine is a ghost story. Here, however, the bad place is not a house like the Marston House or the Overlook Hotel, and the bad thing is embodied not as vampire or werewolf or monster, but as a rust-ridden old car that catches the eye and the fancy of a passing teenager. A young novel in the sense that most of the central characters are in their teens, Christine explores ghostly possession with King's characteristic energy and verve. If the basic story approaches absurdity on one level, a haunted Plymouth, no less, it at least partially redeems itself by the sheer force of its narrative movement. Christine creates a kaleidoscope of cars, rock music. The copyright page lists credits for over 45 songs quoted in the text. Archetypal teenage rebellion against equally archetypal overbearing parents. Mostly Arnie Cunningham's, since Dennis's and Lee's parents hardly figure in the novel. Fast food joints. Incipient sexuality explored in front and back seats, all overlying the frightening insecurities and frustrations of adolescence. Rage without a classroom held hostage or a teenaged terrorist as narrator. Carrie without telekinesis. The long walk without even the release valve of a socially sanctioned way to kill young people. Although driver's licenses come close, as Christine ultimately suggests. Christine is an anatomy of the ambivalences of adolescence. Perhaps not one of King's great novels, it nevertheless has garnered its own following and performs well enough according to its own standards. The King's and Queen's Cars. These days, Stephen tools around in a Mercedes. He has one, and Tabitha has her own. They also have other cars more suited for harsh Maine winters. Stephen King also has a Harley, which he used to ride down to Boston to watch his beloved Red Sox play. I suspect that, because of his atrophied right leg, he's less inclined to do so these days. But in the early days, King's chariots of fire were modest. His first car was a hand-me-down from his brother, a monstrous 1956 Plymouth. In Christine, the haunted car was a 1958 Plymouth Fury. King drove the aged black Plymouth when he was in college. The first car he ever bought new, in cash, was a Ford Pinto, which Stephen could drive, but Tabitha could not. In an introduction to the collector's edition of Carrie, Tabitha King wrote about her own horror story with that car. We bought a better car, a Pinto, but I couldn't drive it because it was a standard shift. I tried, but one day I stalled it on State Street Hill, the steepest one in Bangor. Some flaming asshole behind me pounded his horn and screamed at me. Currently parked in Bangor, a Toyota Prius, a black Pontiac GTO, a Mercedes coupe, and a Mercedes sedan. And, of course, a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And when he's in Florida, King tools around in a red Tesla, or a black Chevrolet Volt, which he bought as a birthday present for Tabitha. As Stephen told the Sarasota Herald Tribune in 2011, I just love it because every time you recharge it for free at a public electric vehicle charging station, it's like saying to the oil cartel, here, stick this in your eye. It is like a license to steal. 40. Rock and Roll Haven. Stephen King's station, WKIT. 100.3 FM. Well, for me, radio, and in particular music, made me real as a kid. It's where I discovered my identity. You reach out and find something that belongs to you, and it's yours. It's difficult to explain, but it's like a pair of shoes that fit you. My first record was a 78 RPM version of Elvis Presley's Hound Dog. From that moment on, I knew it's what I wanted, and I wanted all I could get. Stephen King, Radio and Records, 1984. On Broadway, not far from Bangor High School, there used to be a large sign that read, Z62, WZON, the Zone Corporation. That sign has since been replaced with another, more colorful sign, with artwork by Maine artist Glenn Chadbourne, who has illustrated numerous books by King for Cemetery Dance. The art and King's stylized signature is proof that if you're looking for King's rock and roll radio station, WKIT on the FM dial, you've just found it. Online, it can be found at www.wkitfm.com, and it's billed as Stephen King's Rock and Roll Station. It's where the rock jocks get into the groove, playing the platters that matter. From its website, WKIT 100.3 is a radio station located in Bangor, Maine, and is owned by Stephen and Tabitha King, making it one of the few commercial stations in the country that is still locally owned. We have been a classic rock station ever since Bobby Russell became program director in 1990, and the ratings have always been consistently good, launching us to number one. We can also say we're the only station in the state, and one of the few in the U.S. that is still live 24/7. Meaning we have rock jocks on at all times. If you call, someone is actually here to answer the phone. Stephen King, who played guitar in a high school band, the Mune Spinners, and later played rhythm guitar as a founding member of the Rock Bottom Remainders, had no intention of ever buying a radio station. But circumstances forced his hand. In Between Rock and a Soft Place, Playboy, January 1982, he spoke about picking up a rental car at Boston's Logan Airport to drive home to Bangor. The car radio had AM radio stations only, which frustrated him. He wanted to dial some good rock and roll and turn up the volume until the speakers started to distort, but couldn't do it because there was no hard rock station on the AM band. That was when I began to worry, to seriously worry about rock and roll, he concluded. A year later, King decided to make a sound investment in Bangor, an AM radio station. As he explained in a piece for Castle Rock, October 1987, I did it because the cutting edge of rock and roll has grown dangerously blunt in these latter days. He bought WACZ, which became WZON, on the AM band at 620 kilohertz. Back in the day, you could rock in the dead zone by tuning in on WZON, but today it broadcasts progressive talk radio programs. For rock and roll, listeners tune in to WKIT-FM, which is owned by the Zone Corporation. On the web, you can listen to its programming at http://streamdb4web.securenetsystems.net/v5/WKIT. King also owns WZLO 103.1 FM, which is billed as Maine's Adult Alternative, playing the very best adult rock music. The station's website notes, "On our station, you'll hear everyone from the geniuses who gave birth to the progressive sounds of the 60s and 70s, such as Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Van Morrison, Jackson Browne, and James Taylor, to the musical heirs of those legends like John Mayer, Dave Matthews Band, Norah Jones, Ryan Adams, Sheryl Crow, David Gray, and Mumford & Sons, just to name a few." WZLO's site also boasts that the station is locally owned and operated like so many other great Maine institutions. Not big out-of-state conglomerate with a cookie-cutter approach to radio and a boring playlist. King clearly no longer has to worry, seriously worry, about rock and roll. 41. Pet Cemetery, 1983. Death is a mystery, and burial is a secret. Pet Cemetery. Orrington, Maine. On a cold day in December 1988, I went to see for myself what was left of the Pet Cemetery in Orrington, Maine, located south of Bangor. I pulled my rental car into the parking lot of a nearby convenience store and asked a local where it was. He replied, "There's nothing left up there, you know." I knew that, I told him. I wanted to see the house that the Kings had temporarily rented when Stephen returned to his alma mater for a one-year stint as a writer-in-residence and the actual site of the Pet Cemetery. I soon found myself at a two-story white house with fading paint. It had a used tire hanging on a rope from a tree in the front yard. Past the house lay the site of the Pet Cemetery. There was nothing left because souvenir hunters took what they could, including the makeshift wooden gravestone markers. I took a few pictures and left. Coming back down the hill, I watched in fascination as an 18-wheeler came into view, rising taller as it crested a nearby hill. I was near the road, Route 15, and instinctively stepped back when the large truck passed by me, its wind buffeting me. The road was a winding ribbon of death for stray animals, claiming countless cats and dogs. Smucky. Smucky was Naomi King's tabby. As her father explained about Pet Cemetery and its connections to real life in an interview with the Paris Review, fall 2006. That book was pretty personal. Everything in it, up to the point where the little boy is killed in the road, everything is true. We moved into that house by the road. It was Orrington instead of Ludlow, but the big trucks did go by, and the old guy across the street did say, "You just want to watch him around the road." We did go out in the field. We flew kites. We did go up and look at the Pet Cemetery. I did find my daughter's cat, Smucky, dead in the road, run over. We buried him up in the Pet Cemetery, and I did hear Naomi out in the garage the night after we buried him. I heard all these popping noises. She was jumping up and down on packing material. She was crying and saying, "Give me my cat back. Let God have his own cat." I just dumped that right into the book. And Owen really did go charging for the road. He was this little guy, probably 2 years old. I'm yelling, "Don't do that." And of course he runs faster and laughs because that's what they do at that age. I ran after him and gave him a flying tackle and pulled him down on the shoulder of the road, and a truck just thundered by him. So all of that went into the book. And the book went into the drawer because it was so gruesome by the end of it and so awful. "I mean, there's no hope for anybody at the end of that book," he concluded. He told the Bangor Daily News, October 12, 1988, "In trying to cope with these things, the book ceased being a novel to me and became instead a gloomy exercise, like an endless marathon run. It never left my mind. It never ceased to trouble me. I was trying to teach school and the boy was always there. The funeral home was always there. The mortician's room was always there. And when I finished, I put the book in a drawer. Pet Cemetery is a grim read and an unremitting horror novel. It's a parent's worst nightmare that becomes reality. It's a cautionary tale of a doctor named Lewis Creed, whose credo is to believe in the world of science until he feels it has abandoned him. Lacking hope, he turns to a more primal belief, recalling a classic story, The Monkey's Paw." King's wife agreed it was too dark in tone, and he decided that it should remain unpublished. If anything, it was a Richard Bachman book, not a King story. But circumstances eventually forced his hand and its publication. By then, King was feeling pressure from his readers as well, especially in the fantasy-slash-horror field, because King had given interviews explaining that he had just finished a novel too nasty and too terrifying to publish, which set King fans clamoring for it. But King remained firm. Pet Sematary was buried deep in a drawer, and as far as he was concerned, it would never be unearthed. Resurrection. In The Writer's Home Companion, James Charlton and Lisbeth Mark tell the tale of Doubleday and the IRS forcing King's hand. As they explained, Pet Sematary was published because of a contractual dispute. The problem began when King agreed to take a fixed amount of $50,000 a year from Doubleday, which was drawn from his accumulated royalties. But when the balance kept growing and it rose to $3 million, it was clear that the inflexible payout schedule would take 60 years for King to recover his royalties, not including any new revenue. But Doubleday refused to simply write him a check for the balance in the account, citing contractual and legal issues. The IRS decided that if due consideration was met, and King gave Doubleday Pet Sematary, the unfair contract could be terminated. King acquiesced, and Doubleday was now the publisher of what would prove to be one of King's finest novels, which went to press with 500,000 copies in hardback and went on to sell 657,000 copies. Unlike Christine, published earlier in the year, Pet Sematary was enthusiastically embraced by critics and readers alike. The Portsmouth Herald said it was a work of such skill and quality that it transcends the horror genre to become an unforgettable piece of literature about death and bereavement. At 36, King is not only far from running out of steam, but becoming a better novelist. The book industry's trade publication, Publishers Weekly, also sang the book's praises, in effect saying King had hit the high notes with his latest tale. King's newest novel is a wonderful family portrait that is also the most frightening novel he has ever written. The last 50 pages are so terrifying, one might try to make it through them without a breath. But what is most astonishing here is how much besides horror is here. Witty, wise, observant, King has never been a more humane artist than he is here. Michael Collins's eerily prescient review of Pet Sematary in the Stephen King Companion, 1995, explains why it is a work of unspeakable horror. Pet Sematary is King's darkest novel in part because of the underlying theme that there are things worse than death, and in part because he has spent so much time in the first half lovingly creating an intense relationship between Lewis Creed and his son Gage. The novel is one unrelenting horror following immediately upon, and in fact initiated by, another. Without an emotional or narrative break, the novel penetrates darkness within darkness within darkness, until all that remains is madness or death, or both. The result is one of the few King narratives that move unrelievedly into obsessive pessimism. The cautious optimism of Pet Sematary, where, in the final moment, midnight darkness reigns as undisputed monarch over all. 42. Thinner. 1984. Original title, Gypsy Pie. Richard Bachman is an incredibly talented writer, and Thinner is a riveting novel that gives a new meaning to the word horror. Promotional letter, advance copy of Thinner. A dead giveaway. It's 1984, and I am at the American Booksellers Association convention in Washington, D.C. There are too many publishers' booths to count, each pushing its fall list, among them New American Library, which spared no expense to promote a little-known writer named Richard Bachman. His four previously published novels, issued in mass-market editions only, built up his fan base sufficiently to justify publishing what they hoped would be his breakout book, Thinner. New American Library spared no expense beating the drums and drumming up sales for Bachman. In front of the display, in the aisle, were two square pallets of wood, 46 inches on each side, stacked 4 feet high with advance copies of Thinner, free for the taking. Booksellers, though, rushed by the stacks, ignoring Bachman's free books in their eagerness to get to the Viking booth, because they were promoting the biggest book of the season, The Talisman, a collaboration between Stephen King and Peter Straub. Bachman or King? Thinner was published in hardback, $12.95 retail, in November 1984. The author's photo depicted a friend of Kirby McCauley. Careful readers smiled when they ran across references in the novel to Stephen King. In one scene, Dr. Houston warns Billy Halleck that his tale of a curse had begun to sound a little like a Stephen King novel. Later, this telling line, "If you add Kerry Rossington with his alligator skin and William J. Halleck with his case of involuntary anorexia nervosa into the equation, it starts to sound a little like Stephen King again." It was, in fact, King having a little literary fun with himself. But a careful reader could have picked up the clues that King was Bachman. As Michael Collings wrote in the Stephen King Companion, 1995, "The fifth Bachman novel is also closest to what readers have come to expect from Stephen King. The first four contained implicit clues, particularly when we read with the gift of superior hindsight, as to who Richard Bachman really was. Place names connect, as when one notes that Ray Garrity's mailing address is apparently the same as Johnny Smith's father's in The Dead Zone, 1979. Rural delivery, Pownall, Maine. Brand names connect, especially the Blue Ribbon Laundry and Roadwork, in a branch of which Margaret White is working in Cary. Dedications to Jim Bishop, Bert Hatlin, and others already familiar to King's readership add to these connections, along with a gritty, tough-talk tone that King had already mastered when Cary appeared, and stories that were consistent with King's recurrent themes. The thread unravels. In January 1985, a Washington, D.C. bookstore clerk who had researched copyright forms filed for Bachman's books discovered that all were registered to Richard Bachman except his first book, Rage. That one was registered to Stephen King. Filed by someone at the literary agency owned by King's agent at the time, Kirby McCauley, the error proved to be incontrovertible evidence. Further denial was useless. The bookstore clerk wrote to King, explaining what he had discovered. By then, the thread was already unraveling fast. By late January, a major television show, Entertainment Tonight, ran a story speculating that King and Bachman were one and the same. Also, in its second issue, the official King newsletter, Castle Rock, announced that it had big news, a secret revealed at last. Then in February, Joan H. Smith of the Bangor Daily News told King that she was going to run the King-Bachman story, confirmation or not. The story, unfortunately, was rushed to print and filled with factual errors. Haste, as the saying goes, makes waste. The story prompted King to write a letter to the editor, which was published, setting the record straight. Here's how it looked to me. 1. King did not try to time the release of the information to benefit two Bachman books optioned for the movies. Both had sold on their own before the revelation came to light. 2. King had in fact confirmed the pen name to Steve Brown, a bookstore clerk, a month before the newspaper article was published. 3. King felt that there was no point in further denial and opted to confirm Joan Smith's story, since it was scheduled to run anyway. 4. Noting fan criticism about his use of a pen name, King asserted that the fans had confused enjoyment with ownership. He was not being mean-spirited and deliberately withholding the Bachman books from his constant readers. The Before the confirmation, Bachman, unassisted, had sold 28,000 copies of Thinner, which had gone into a second printing. A very respectable showing for a mid-list author who was slowly building his readership. The anthology Fangoria, Masters of the Dark, published in 1997 and edited by Anthony Timpone, prints an interview with King by Edward Gross. Stephen King Takes a Vacation, in which King explained that, with the last Bachman novel, Thinner, my wife said, "You know it's your own goddamned fault. You knew it was like the other ones. Somebody was bound to recognize it. If it was Joe Schmo, nobody would have cared. Instead, you've got this guy who was familiar with the Library of Congress and works at a bookstore. He deliberately tracks down the copyrights, and our tracks were covered, except for the first one." Thinner immediately went back to press to meet the increasing demand, and by the time the presses stopped, 280,000 copies were in print. But the Hunger Games had just started. Fans also wanted the earlier Bachman books, but only two of them were in print. New American Library then issued an omnibus edition to satisfy the growing demand. The Bachman books, four early novels, included Rage, 1977, The Long Walk, 1979, Roadwork, 1981, and The Running Man, 1982. The book also included an introduction, Why I Was Bachman. Though King had put on a brave face in public, in private he seethed. As he told the Maryland Coast Dispatch, "I was pissed. It's like you can't have anything. You're not allowed to because you are a celebrity. What does it matter? Why should anyone care? It's like they can't wait to find stuff out, particularly if it's something you don't want people to know. That's the best. That's the juice. It makes me think about that Don Henley song, Dirty Laundry. Hell, give it to them." As for the book itself, Michael Collings pointed out that it is the first Bachman novel to approach the intensity, complexity, horrific texturing, and wide market appeal that the King books had long since demonstrated, and that King's private hope was that Dickey might gradually build his own faithful audience, unhindered by the expectations and hoopla that automatically attached to a novel under King's name. King, Collings wrote, notes that Misery might have been Bachman's breakthrough novel. The first Bachman book, Rage. Rage, the first Bachman book, has a singular distinction among King's published fiction. It is out of print, and deliberately so. Four separate school shootings were linked to the novel. In each case, a connection to Rage had been established. In one particularly deadly case, three people were killed by a 14-year-old in Kentucky whose school locker contained a copy of, you guessed it, Rage. King told his publisher to take the book out of print immediately. "I pulled it because, in my judgment, it might be hurting people, and that made it the responsible thing to do," he wrote in Guns, an e-book published on Amazon in 2013. The book, King said, was a possible accelerant. Tapping into his feelings of alienation as a young student himself, King had written too convincingly of an angry teenage boy who held his class hostage at Placerville High School. "The morning I got it on was nice, a nice May morning. What made it nice was that I'd kept my breakfast down, and the squirrel I spotted in Algebra 2, 2 years ago. To the best of my recollection, that was about the time I started to lose my mind." Here's Johnny, Dickie. Richard Bachman died of cancer of the pseudonym, as King said, but two novels were posthumously published. King published The Regulators in 1996 and Blaze in 2007 under the name Bachman. Obviously, dead men do tell tales. 43. The Talisman, 1984. As Casey Stengel used to say, You've got to put an asterisk by it. Stephen King, quoted in Winter's Stephen King, The Art of Darkness. When you combine Stephen King with Peter Straub, what do you get? You get a book with a print run so large that it took 9 warehouses strategically placed around the country to ensure a national laydown on the same day, October 8, 1984. A major book from 2 major authors with no book club sales to erode trade bookstore sales. And gleeful critics lined up to take a swing at King and Straub as they ran the proverbial gauntlet. King, who termed himself a bestsellosaurus rex, and who was used to suffering the slings and arrows that accompanied his outrageously good fortune, found that this time criticisms were more barbed. In horror fiction, People magazine asserted, 2 heads are better than only 1 if they're on the same body. Ouch. It began to really hurt, though, when Esquire magazine wrote, King, whose own style is American Yahoo, big, brassy, and bodacious, has always expressed admiration for Straub's cooler, less emotional diction, and Straub in turn has praised the grand operatic quality of King's work. Their collaboration is both cool and operatic, and very, very scary. It's a horrific work of art, but is it really art? Probably not. We are talking about mass-market books and popular music here. People consume horror in order to be scared, not arted. Regardless of whether the reading audience was scared or arted, The Talisman quickly racked up sales, totaling an impressive 880,000 copies within 2 months of publication. An ambitious novel of 653 pages, The Talisman was followed by a sequel in 2001, Black House. During a book tour in November 2014 for Revival, King announced that he and Straub planned to write in 2015 a 3rd book in the series. Perhaps what the critics expected was a horror novel in which the 2 would collaborate and bring their respective strengths to the table. Instead, what The Talisman delivers is an ambitious cross-genre novel in which the 2 writing styles are seamlessly integrated, to the point where it's not certain who wrote what, which was by design. As Peter Straub recalled in an interview for Tenebre, for its special double issue on Stephen King, he and King had discussed collaborating on a novel when King was living in England, where Straub also then lived. But because of their respective contractual obligations, the planned collaboration had to be postponed for the next 4 years. It became logistically possible to collaborate when the Straubs moved back to the United States, as had the Kings. Straub told Tenebre, Steve drove from Maine to my house in Westport, Connecticut, to start the actual writing. He stayed maybe 4 days, during which we wrote the first 15 or 20 pages, taking turns at my word processor. Then he went back to Maine, and I spent 10 days writing up a 70-page, single-spaced outline based on everything we had discussed. After that, he continued from where we had left off, transmitted his pages to me, and I picked up from his last sentence. We went on like this for about 1.5 years, each of us firing off 100-page, 150-page segments at intervals of 1 month or so. When we were nearing the end, my wife and I went back to Maine, and Steve and I wrote the last 50 or so pages at his house, taking turns sitting down before his machine. Not long after submission, our editor joined us at Steve's place, and we went through the book, making whatever cuts and changes seemed necessary. The final result was a book that was neither in King's voice nor in Straub's, but in a 3rd voice that was only possible as a result of careful collaboration. For that reason, the book wasn't exactly what King fans expected, and it wasn't exactly what Straub's fans expected, but it did find a ready audience willing to go along for the ride. Michael Collings on The Talisman. The Talisman was an intricately interlaced combination of horror and fantasy, or real-world terror and alternate universe science fantasy in which atomic testing in our world can create vast expanses of the wastelands in the territories, and perhaps in the world of Roland of Gilead as well. Instead of allusions to Poe and Lovecraft, The Talisman echoes Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, Mark Twain and The Wizard of Oz. Its structure echoes the immensely popular Xanth and Proton/Phase novels of Pierce Anthony, both ultimately amalgams of science fiction and fantasy of this world and others. Instead of King's vividly colloquial prose or Straub's coolly ironic academic tone, a third, almost wholly unexpected voice emerged, one appropriate not to the ultimate in horror, but to an extended narrative that takes on a pacing and movement of its own. And instead of a single-minded quest to destroy, or at least incapacitate, a monster, there is the open-ended epic quest for the talisman, the mystic nexus of possible worlds, an image as ethereal and powerful as Jake's vision of the Dark Tower itself in The Wastelands. Even given the length of the talisman, it would be nearly impossible to do justice to the mythic echoes the talisman evokes, or to the multiple landscapes in this world and in the territories that lead to the Black Hotel and the confrontation between light and darkness. That King and Straub also incorporated critiques of contemporary politicians and writers, of social and economic conditions, of education, of parenting. All of this made the talisman more difficult to approach, and hence seemed to justify the cavils of reviewers and critics. It did not, however, keep the novel from reaching literally millions of readers. In the decade that has followed its first appearance, The Talisman has emerged to be ranked as one of King's and Straub's stronger novels. The Talisman leaves behind the anti-heroic naturalism of much modern fiction and returns to the same roots that underlie Tolkien and Lewis and, even in its own way, the Mark Twain of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, to the prose epic impulse that King has already evoked in The Stand and The Dark Tower. Anthologist Peter Straub. Readers who know Straub's work only through his two collaborations with Stephen King or through his novels, Ghost Story, Julia, Floating Dragon, Shadowland, to name a few, shouldn't be surprised to discover that he is a first-rate anthologist as well. Published as a two-book set in slipcase with 1,500 pages, American Fantastic Tales spans horror stories from the Edwardian era to the 20th century. As with any anthology, depending on your taste, some of your favorites are bound to be missing. What is important is that it's a very good representative sampling of horror fiction that offers something for everyone. Of course, there's Stephen King and Ray Bradbury and Edgar Allan Poe, but there's much more. As Straub told Scott Simon of NPR, October 31st, 2009, I wanted to get a good representation of stories from across the decades, from as early as possible to the present. And otherwise, I was looking for really, really good stories. In some cases, when I got into the pulps, I was looking for very bizarre stories of the sort that only flourished in pulp fiction. In other words, it didn't matter where the stories originally appeared. It only mattered that they were good. How good? In a Washington Post review, October 31st, 2009, Dennis Trabell wrote, "Inside this double-decker set lurks more spookiness than you can shake a broomstick at. 40 and more tales, written by horripilating favorites, H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, Poppy Z. Bright, mainstream powerhouses, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Willa Cather, John Cheever, and revenants from the crypt of literary obscurity, Madeline Yale Wynn, W.C. Morrow, Seabury Quinn. Until now, the best and bulkiest anthology of its kind was Herbert A. Wise and Phyllis Fraser's Great Tales of Terror and the Supernatural, 1944. But these new, paired volumes, edited by novelist Peter Straub of Ghost Story fame, almost double the length of Great Tales while casting a wider net. Wise and Fraser eschewed authors who published mainly in pulp magazines, with the notable exception of Lovecraft. But Straub embraces pulpiness in the first volume's subtitle. The idea seems to be that, whatever the source, all Goosebumps are created equal. I'll shiver to that. Peter Straub on Fiction. Peter Straub, interviewed by Rick Kelly for the Library of America newsletter online, had the following to say about fiction. All fiction, literary or genre, seeks to manipulate its readers. Every novel is an effort to present a completely formed and coherent view of the way its particular world works, and every novelist is doing her best to make her case persuasive. As Marilynne Robinson once remarked, novelists are always standing on top of a hill, shouting, "No, you're all wrong. This is how the world works." In this regard, there is no essential difference between the writer of a literary novel and the writer of a crime novel. The differences have to do with matters other than manipulation. Open-endedness, psychological acuity, formal beauty, the quality of the prose, depth of feeling, alertness to ambiguity, suggestions of the world's depth and richness, supple transitions, and 100 other things. A writer of the fantastic may or may not possess the kind of writerly authority implied by these considerations, but if she does, her work might as well be called literary. It won't be, though. The fences are too high. However, to be completely frank, work of this kind is always as good, in a literary sense, as most literary efforts, and often better than most. 44. Douglas E. Winter's Stephen King, The Art of Darkness. 8 years after Stephen King published Carrie, two books, not by but about Stephen King, were published. The books came out from specialty presses, one from Underwood Miller and the other from Starmont House. The first was Fear Itself, the horror fiction of Stephen King, edited by Tim Underwood and Chuck Miller, which included essays from 11 contributors, including King's On Becoming a Brand Name, reprinted from Adelina, February 1980. The book featured an introduction by Peter Straub, Meeting Stevie. One of the other contributors was Douglas E. Winter, whose essay, The Night Journeys of Stephen King, was reprinted, with revisions, from an issue of Fantasy Newsletter. The second was titled, simply, Stephen King, and written by Douglas E. Winter. Both publishers, Underwood Miller and Starmont House, went on to publish additional titles about King, but these two were the first of many to appear in print. Of the two, Stephen King proved to be more influential, paving the way for its extensively revised and updated version. In 1984, Douglas E. Winter's authorized study/appreciation, Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, was published in hardback by New American Library Books to critical acclaim. Then a lawyer by day, now a retired partner, and writer, editor, anthologist, novelist, and rock musician by night, Winter described his book as a critical appreciation. It is an intermingling of biography, literary analysis, and unabashed enthusiasm, spiced with commentary by Stephen King transcribed from our more than 12 hours of recorded conversations, including the only interview that he intends to give on the subject of his novel, Pet Sematary. Following the introduction is a chapter titled Notes Toward a Biography, which implied that he intended to write an authorized biography of King. Though Winter did go on to write a full-length authorized biography, it would be on Clive Barker, not Stephen King. For the 1989 edition of The Stephen King Companion, Winter consented to an interview. As expected, his answers were thoughtful, deliberate, and illuminating. I asked, "What kind of reaction have you gotten from people who've read your book on King?" He replied, "It's all been good. I got a ton of letters when the book first came out. I would always get these letters from school kids, from teachers, from librarians, from federal prisoners, all telling me how much they enjoyed the book. There's obviously a tremendous number of Stephen King fans out there, and I think this was the sort of thing that they were waiting for. That was perfect for them, because it more or less organized the fiction, and I think also served as a real companion, and I hope illuminated the books a great deal." That was the intent of it, to say, here's not only some fiction that you're reading for enjoyment, but there are messages, there are themes, there are subtexts here that are important. To me, that's always been key. To consider what fiction is all about and how it affects me and my thinking. I always hated when people discount Steve as being just an entertainer, because he's not. The same thing's true about other major writers of horror fiction. And here was my opportunity to make clear some very significant things that were going on. Winter, an early critic of King fiction, paved the way and showed critics who followed not only that King was a writer to be taken seriously, but also that to write about King's work required a serious frame of mind. Today, 30 years after its initial publication, which was followed by updated editions in trade paperback and mass market paperback, Stephen King, The Art of Darkness, remains a seminal book about King. Anthologies. If you have any interest in horror fiction, you should not walk but run to your nearest bookstore